From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell unveils a new education plan for Boston Public Schools. Is it enough of a solution?
It's a very, very big systemic problem. And to that end, there's not a simple solution to any of that.
Also today, a new WBUR poll on drug prices finds a majority of the state says drug prices are too high.
I think that the drug companies are getting too big for their britches. I do. I think they need to have some kind of humanity going on in there.
And Ocean Vuong on writing a story of immigrants and the opioid crisis in his new novel, On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous.
I saw this book like a flower. Every petal is its own thing, but it requires all of the petals blooming in unison to create a rose. And I think that's what American life is.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Boston public school system needs urgent change, according to City Council President Andrea Campbell. She unveiled a plan today to address systemic inequity in the city's school system. Councilor Campbell joins us now in the studio to talk about it. Hello, Councilor.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's great to be with you.
We should mention to our listeners, we have a link to your 16-page plan on our website, radioboston.org. Yep, for anyone who wants to see it in its entirety. It has four key components ranging from responsiveness of the central office to access to quality education in schools from early childhood all the way through high school. Your plan starts with a definition of equity, and it struck me that you call for the school system to align on a common set of values. And the first thought that came to me was, did we ever have a common set of values about our schools?
And the short answer is, I don't think so. I started the meetings and the conversations to put together this report in January. And why did I do it? So, you know, I care deeply about the issue of education. Born and raised in the city of Boston, I'm a product of Boston Public Schools. I went to 5 BPS schools, including Boston Latin School. And I leave Latin, I go up to Princeton University and UCLA Law School. And by all measures, I'm a success story. But what I recognize is that this system didn't show up the same way for some of my peers, including my own twin brother, who I talk about often. He is the reason.
You spoke about him with us.
That's right. He is the reason I do this work. Instead of graduating from high school and going off to reach his God-given potential, cycles in another criminal justice system, passes away while in the custody of the Department of Correction at the age of 29. And there's one system I know that failed him, and that was BPS. And so rather than stay in a space of pain and frustration, and I've named the inequities along the way, whether in council hearings, meetings with my school leaders at schools in my district, schools outside my district, talk to families, this was an opportunity to come up with a pragmatic action plan. And before you jump into action steps, I asked hundreds of stakeholders, why are we stuck? Why can't we seem to move forward in BPS? And what came up in that conversation was, what are we moving towards and why? What is the underlying purpose and what are those values? And so in this report, everything is couched in a definition of equity. And in addition to that, for the sub areas, we choose principles and values. And these principles and values, some of my own thinking, along with teachers, educators, retired BPS employees, current BPS employees, families, students, many inform these guiding principles. And I hope that the district, the new superintendent, and others will see them as a step in the right direction. But you can't possibly do this work well if you don't have a value system, or as many companies might say, or organizations, a mission statement of sorts. And that's what this is.
So your equity vision does have a set of values in it and a couple of key things. One that really struck me was this idea that children and young people should be able to self-determine, sort of choose the path they want and be on it, and that we have to really ensure equity and access to schools and access to quality and to choice. So how do we as a city, from elected leaders, school leaders, community leaders, parents, unite around that definition of equity if we've never had this common set of values before?
That's right. And so what I started with was meetings. Sometimes they were at schools. Sometimes they were in communities, people's homes, right? A lot of this has been informed not just by the work we did this year and last year, but even when I was a candidate, door-knocking folks and asking them about issues they cared about. And I looked at definitions of equity from other large cities, other school districts, other reports. There's been some recommendations. In a budget hearing with our own BPS leadership, we had been talking about equity. And I paused and I said, Superintendent, you know, what is our definition of equity? And a few folks said, that's a good question. So that told me that we really needed something to work with. And I wanted a definition that people could wrap their head around that was sort of in lay terms. And for me, what we came up with, I think, is really great. And I say we, I mean, because it was informed by many. And I'm going to read it because I think it's that special. You know, equity is giving every child what they need to succeed in school and pursue the life of their choosing. In Boston, we must commit to the idea that those who have the least deserve the most from our public schools.
So I want to pick up on that.
Yes.
So parity and equity are closely related. Your number two priority is essentially parity and access to quality schools. Boston has a fraught history with how it's attempted to achieve this, from, you know, the busing debacle after the 1974 court decision to desegregate our schools. How do you achieve fair, equitable access to quality schools no matter where students live when we've been trying to solve that problem for a long time?
That's right. I mean, I think first it is understanding that when you do everything from an equity lens, and in this particular case, we hope it's a definition that the district might adopt or at least have an open mind about adopting or have a conversation about, it is recognizing that when we say ensuring that this school district gives those who have the least, that means our English language learners, our special needs students, those who need more supports from our system. It also means grappling with that history, the underbelly of the history of the city of Boston that involves segregation, racial inequities, of course, busing, much in the school context. My father, who was born in Roxbury in 1933, was a graduate of BPS himself, Boston Tech. We often heard these stories growing up in the city of Boston. So this equity definition also calls upon us to serve those communities that have been marginalized or excluded or underserved or under-resourced for a long time. And that is our Black and brown communities in the city of Boston that still live in neighborhoods where the access to a quality school is not great.
One of the other groups of young people that you just mentioned there were young people who are English language learners or require special education. Is it realistic to think that we can get more such programs in the high-quality schools within the 1 to 3 year time period that you're calling for? How are you going to get that done?
Absolutely. We have to be intentional. And when you actually do things with an equity framework and a certain type of guiding values, it can happen. If you don't have those values guiding you that say, for our special needs students, our English language learners, those who have the most need, we cannot continue to concentrate them in our high schools that are under-resourced or underperforming. We have to make sure that they have an opportunity to be assigned to our tier one schools. And so in this plan, it talks about the district coming up with a plan not only to expand the tier one classification of schools. So right now, there's not enough.
So you want more of them.
More quality. But then saying we have to be intentional about shifting where our special programs for our English language learners, for our special needs students are concentrated. Right now, they're concentrated, say, in open enrollment high schools or those schools that are struggling because they are tasked with meeting the needs of a large percentage of students. Sometimes the majority of students in their buildings have special needs and English language learner students with special needs as well. So we have to disperse that across all of our schools. Every school should take their fair share of students who have needs. That's what equity calls for. So this is an opportunity for us to do that. And I'll just name one stat that really resonated with me. You know, as a resident in Mattapan, I have a 21-month-old son. We're thinking about schools now, of course. I absolutely want him to go to BPS. If you live in Mattapan, you have a 5% rate, right, or access rate to a high-quality school. If you live in other parts of the city of Boston, say downtown Boston, it's 80%. Or in some areas, it might be higher than that. That's astounding. So that clearly tells us we have to do something swiftly.
It is.
But we can.
And to that point, what do you say to people who read your plan and say, okay, well, to make this more fair for some, we're going to have to make it less fair for others? So do you take away from the 80% in order to increase that 5%? And isn't that a legitimate concern of parents as well?
I don't think so. I am very mindful of that, and I've heard that framing, and I always say, if any system is failing some, it's failing all of us. Those students that don't do well in school, and this might be a tangent, where do they go? Who do they turn into? They're probably not the most productive members of our society. So if we're failing them now, we're also failing them later, which has an impact on all of us, all of our community. So I truly believe we're all in this together. And to make a system equitable, fair to all, there's a way to do that. There's a way to do it without taking away anything from anyone to make sure that this system shows up. Right now, it's showing up for some, but not many. And if you look at the population of our BPS schools and the students, you know, we're talking about a high percentage of students of color, over 80%, special needs students, English language learners, high percentages, almost so that when you add all those populations up, it's almost 90% of our student population that falls into some of these subcategories. So all of our students need a lot in BPS.
So, Counselor Campbell, we've got a new superintendent coming in, incoming Superintendent Brenda Caselius. She spoke to us in May and named a number of things that are necessary to make schools more equitable.
What matters for that is overall school funding and making sure that all schools are funded equitably, which is really important. The mayor and his commitment to early childhood and getting the first 1,000 days of a child's life. And then also looking at getting and ensuring all schools have high-quality, competent, and caring teachers within them and a strong school leader, and then also making sure that there are rigorous offerings within schools.
What about resources? Does BPS have what it needs to provide what you're outlining in this plan? And if they don't, how are they going to get it?
So I think with a school budget that's over $1 billion and continues to increase, I think there are plenty of resources there. I think what we need to talk about is, where is the money going? How is it being used? Where are the inefficiencies in the system? How do we move things around? How do we make tough choices? I also, at the same time, though, I'm at the state, just like our mayor, just like our superintendent, saying, fix the student formula so that our state resources increase. Give us the money you owe us for our charter schools. Right now, we are not being fully reimbursed for our charter schools, and that's a problem. And that's state law. That's a mandate. Not being fulfilled by the state. But when I look at the local level and where I sit and the power I have, with over $1 billion and in some cases a declining student population or stagnant population in some parts of the district, we have to be doing better. And the overall budget of BPS keeps going up. But we can't just keep putting money at the issue. We have to have accountability metrics. We have to have a plan. And I hope that this action plan, which I hope is very pragmatic, is a catalyst to move us in the right direction. But I think we have a lot of resources now to get this right.
So to that point, accountability of the central office in the district is key to your plan. You, as you said, you know, you have your sphere of authority and not sphere of authority. You don't have direct control over the city's public schools. So how are you going to ensure that the district implements the changes you're calling for?
I mean, one of the things that we do have as a counselor and as the Boston City Council, the legislative branch of government, is we're responsible for the overall budget of the city of Boston. You know, we take our votes on Wednesday. And I think there's ways in which we can push for the system to show up better for all families and to hold them accountable. But one thing I wanted to do with this plan was to make sure that there were concrete action items that everyone could wrap their head around, including our families, our parents, our students, our teachers, our school leaders. You know, we're calling for the central office to do specific things, including overhauling our welcome centers so they're more welcoming to families, more customer service oriented. All these things can happen. We attach a timeline that we hope the district might say, you know what? Yes, let's do that. So I hope by using the authority of the council to review the budget, we're asking the tough questions. We also have an opportunity here with specific ideas and thoughts. I didn't want to just talk about the inequities. I also wanted to put forth ideas. And I'm like, here you go. Now work with me. And I look forward to working with the new superintendent.
So excuse me for interrupting. We're short on time. And I want to get at least one parent
voice. You mean we can't stay here all day?
No, we can't. This is Travis Marshall of a parent organization, Quality Education for Every Student. And he's also a BPS parent.
That's there oftentimes are moments where there is a feeling that the parent and families and students themselves are sort of last in line in the conversation. That sort of feels like the plans are created up, on high and eventually come down to individual school communities and the families that make up those communities. And by the time they're there, they're pretty much set in stone.
Just very briefly, how do you flip that around to make parents and families feel more heard while also giving school leaders what they need?
And I absolutely agree with his assessment. In the report, we put forth a diagram. It's a triangle that we flip. We say we need the central office to completely flip its accountability way of thinking. The central office is accountable to our school leaders, and the school leaders are accountable to our families and our students. The families and the students are the foundation. That's who we all answer to. And right now, they shouldn't be at the bottom. They should be at the top informing this conversation. And we hope that the ideas we have set forth with respect to that, that the district adopts them and that the superintendent, who I look forward to working with, also makes it a part of her plan.
Well, equity, accountability, and keeping families at the top. Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, we begin WBUR's week-long series on the price of health care. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A new WBUR poll finds nearly one in three Massachusetts residents who's filled a prescription in the last year has struggled to afford it. And more than one in four have skipped doses or rationed pills because of concerns about cost. This even though the vast majority of Massachusetts residents have health insurance coverage. In a moment, we'll check in with WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg on a new week-long series called The Price of Health. But first, we want to bring you a report from WBUR's Karen Weintraub, who introduces us to one of those patients struggling to afford their medications.
Joanne Roten actually has two forms of insurance, Medicare and supplemental insurance. But like three-quarters of Massachusetts residents, Roten still finds the cost of medications unreasonable.
I think that the drug companies are getting too big for their britches. I can say that, right? I do. I think they need to have some kind of humanity going on in there.
Roten is 73, with long white hair she pulls back in a ponytail. She's been struggling with diabetes for nearly a quarter century. She carefully tests her blood sugar 3 to 5 times a day and balances it against what she eats and how much she exercises.
When you have diabetes, it affects every organ in your body.
Right.
So you have to take care of your body.
But living on a fixed income makes it tough for Roten to afford her diabetes medication, in addition to all the other medications she takes. A cholesterol drug, pills for high blood pressure, thyroid problems and sleep issues, a daily aspirin, two antidepressants, and an inhaler to help her breathe. Roten drives herself to the drugstore near her Everett home pretty much every week. She's on a first-name basis with the pharmacist.
But the total for today is this much, $159.46.
So that's a good healthy feeding of my charge card, don't you think? $160. I just got done paying something on it, and I put this on, and it goes back up.
Roten is doing okay right now financially, since she inherited her ex-husband's Social Security benefits. But already this year, she's spent $378 for her diabetes treatment and more than $1,200 total on medications. Without insurance, today's $90 bill for insulin would have been more than $3,500.
Is that incredible? I mean, that's almost laughable, isn't it?
Price isn't the only challenge. Medicare and Roten's insurance company decide what brand of insulin she can use and what monitoring system. And sometimes they change those decisions. Roten had to adjust to both a new drug and a new blood sugar monitor in the last few years.
So they're like sort of dictating what a person can get and can't get. And you can't shop around because they got the call on it, you know what I mean?
Right.
Medicare has said these are the only ones that you can have, so that's all you can do.
It's a common problem. In a new WBUR poll, more than a third of Massachusetts residents who have recently taken a medication say they've been told their insurance wouldn't cover a prescription. Roten cuts corners where she can to try to save money. She says she reuses her needles to make them last longer, but they get dull fast and then hurt going in. Roten also has saved money by getting extra supplies from friends and relatives. A neighbor gave her needle-tipped pens she uses to inject insulin.
God is so good to me. He really is. And also when my aunt died, she had some, so I got hers. And my cousin died, I got his.
Still, sometimes she rations her insulin to make it go further.
I'm supposed to take 54 units in the morning and 48 units at night. So what I might do is just take 50 in the morning and then just take, you know, 40 at night. But then I wake up with high blood sugar, so that's not good. When you're backed up against a wall, I mean, you have to do something. And I'm sure that I'm not the only person that has diabetes that is doing this sort of stuff.
We suspect that there are a lot more that are doing it, and we don't even know.
Dr. Bob Gabay is the chief medical officer at Joslin Diabetes Center in Boston, where Roten gets her diabetes care. He says he's not sure how many of his own patients struggle to pay for insulin. It's a difficult conversation to have.
It often takes a little bravery on their part to be able to share that, because it's for many people it's a bit embarrassing to have to talk about their inability to afford things.
There's no question, he and others say, that keeping blood sugar levels stable is essential for patients' health long term.
They can reduce their risks of heart disease and stroke and blindness and kidney failure and amputations dramatically, more than 50% for sure.
That's David Nathan, who directs the Diabetes Center at the Massachusetts General Hospital and is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
These complications are extraordinarily expensive, both in terms, of course, human terms, but also in financial terms, so that the better that we are able to prevent those complications, the better we can reduce costs overall, and human costs in particular.
This is all part of a national debate over how to make healthcare work better for patients without stifling medical innovation. Joanne Roten certainly wants to pay less at her local drugstore. She also wouldn't say no to a cure.
That report from WBUR's Karen Weidtraub. It's the first story in WBUR's week-long series, The Price of Health. And joining us now in studio for more on the series and what to expect is WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Tiziana.
Okay, that was a powerful story there from Karen.
Yeah, I think there's nothing better than a vivid personal story to bring home an issue. Although in this case, a lot of us don't need help bringing this issue home because we're already feeling it at home, right? Like this, as you said, this story is part of a series, and the series included a poll which found, let's just go over these numbers again, nearly a third of the Massachusetts residents who were polled who filled a prescription in the last year had trouble affording it, and almost one in four of them said that cost kept them from filling a prescription on schedule. Now, those numbers jibe pretty well with national numbers, so for any of us who tend to feel complacent about the near universal health insurance coverage we have here in Massachusetts, I think it's a reminder that coverage isn't the end of the story when affording medicine is still a problem for so many people.
And Carrie, the poll also found that more than three quarters of respondents said they think drug prices are unreasonable. What
right.
else did it find?
So two out of three respondents said drug prices are just a major problem in general. So I think that's further indication that this is going to be a big issue in the upcoming campaign season. Because it's a policy question, but it's also what's called a kitchen table issue, right? It hits us where we live.
So did poll respondents have anything to say about how they think we should try to lower those costs?
Yes. So the strongest support was for making it easier for low-cost generic drugs to be approved. Nearly half say they want the government to be able to negotiate the prices of drugs paid for by Medicaid or Medicare. And 44% want it to be legal to buy medicines from abroad.
Okay. So if this poll is the launching point of a special special series we're going to have all week. Yep. What can we expect to explore next?
Well, so tomorrow we're going to hear from Bostonomics reporter Callum Borchers exploring what I think is a really fascinating question of why do the typical rules of economics not seem to apply when it comes to drug prices? So we'll be returning through the series, by the way, to rising insulin prices. And I think it just doesn't seem to make sense. Like, this is a drug, insulin, that's been around for nearly a century, hasn't changed much at all. So why does a vial of insulin that cost $21 in 1996 now cost $275? Like, I'm eager to understand that myself. I don't get it.
Yeah, Joanne's clip. I mean, you hear her talking about rationing, and frankly, it should be surprising, but it's not.
It's not, no. And it's expensive. And why is it getting more expensive?
Right. And on Wednesday, we're going to aim to have a conversation here on Radio Boston with a drug pricing expert on how much drugs actually should cost.
Right. And that's the same day as my piece on that topic. It's about this little nonprofit based here in Boston called ICER, the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, that's acting more and more like the nation's drug pricing watchdog. Like, they actually calculate based on a complex model how much value a drug gives to patients. And so then they can call out drug makers that overcharge. Now, in other developed countries, they have a whole government agency that performs this function. Here in the U.S., we've got this obscure little Boston outfit like trying to inject some economic rationality into drug prices. And then on Thursday, we have Karen Weintraub back again. Again, she'll be looking at diabetes innovation because, you know, high drug prices are supposed to pay for better treatments, at least in part.
So one of the things that I keep thinking as we talk here, Carrie, is how do we fix this? And to that point, today, President Trump actually issued an executive order on health care costs.
Yes.
Tell us what that order does.
So it centers around transparency. It calls for rules that would require hospitals and insurers to tell patients in advance how much a treatment will cost them so they can shop around. Now, that might sound familiar because we've got a law like that on the books here in Massachusetts. I'd say we've already learned here that it's a lot easier said than done.
And as you mentioned, nearly half of poll respondents want the government to negotiate drug prices.
Right.
And that's in line with a big promise of President Trump's on the campaign trail. Here he is on the eve of the New Hampshire primary in 2016 in Londonderry.
When our country purchases drugs, we're the largest drug purchaser in the world. I'm talking about prescription drugs, all kinds of drugs, drugs to make you better. We barely even negotiate with the drug companies.
And yet the administration has actually done little to really bring prices down by negotiating with drug companies.
Right.
So bring it back to Massachusetts. What's going on here to bring down those prices?
Well, we're going to get into that on Friday with Martha Biebinger's story about the state of play in the state house here. There are some really interesting proposals in the works to require more information about how drug companies set their prices. They kind of pull them out of the air a little bit to negotiate with drug makers for deeper discounts, to cap payments for the most expensive drugs or the drugs whose prices have shot up recently. So in short, we in Massachusetts, we're not just taking high drug prices lying down, but what we'll do to change the prices still remains to be seen.
WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Carrie, thanks for being here today.
You're welcome.
Listeners, stay tuned to WBUR all week as our special series, The Price of Health, continues. Stay with us. After the break, we will hear from writer Ocean Vuong on his new novel, On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Ocean Vuong's family is from Vietnam, resettling in Hartford, Connecticut as refugees in 1990 when he was 2 years old. Vuong is now a writer, a poet, and also teaches at UMass Amherst. And back in 2016, his collection of poetry called Night Sky with Exit Wounds received many accolades, including a T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry and comparisons to Emily Dickinson. His new book, his first novel, is called On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. We spoke with Ocean in studio earlier today about his writing.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
It is a pleasure to have you. Ocean, the book is a letter that a young boy named Little Dog writes to his illiterate mother. The family live in Hartford, Connecticut. They're refugees from the Vietnam War. Where did you get this idea, a letter to a mother, your mother, it seems, mm-hmm. who will never read it because she can't?
Yeah, it seemed almost comically futile, the project. Why write a letter, and at that, a 240-page letter, to someone who will never receive it? But I think the very futility of it was what excited me as a writer, because when the recipient is not promised, the pressure now falls on language itself. And I think one could argue that language, particularly the English language, is another character in this book. When the project of communication fails or falters, the question then is, does language matter? Can the sentence be an architecture for our feelings? And it was ultimately the experiment of the book to venture into American life with language and see where it takes us and where it fails us, which it often does.
I will say, though, as a reader and listening to you say that, if you had posed that question to me as I closed the book when I finished it, I would have said, well, clearly this book shows that language absolutely matters.
Yes.
And that it can stand on its own to tell a story.
Yes, yes. I feel that way as a writer, as a professor of English. But I think one of the pleasures of the book is that you get your chance to orchestrate the stakes. And for a reader entering this book, you start to see that the stakes are built up towards that reality. You know, I could stand in front of an audience and say, well, language matters, and that would be fine enough. But then folks would think, well, how? Why? And I guess the book is my attempt at asking how and why.
To that point, you have said about this book that you wanted to start with the truth and end with art.
Yes.
That feels like the trajectory that you're talking about. Tell our listeners, what do you mean by that?
It was an exciting moment, I think, in responding and participating in the American lineage of the autobiography. That lineage begins with Herman Melville and Moby Dick, right in Nantucket. You know, people rarely write of Moby Dick as an autobiographical book, but it is. Herman lived that life. And so I think I'm participating in a lineage that I was dropped into, and a lineage, an American lineage that I'm inspired by, where the I, the historical I, is malleable. It can be tested and transformed through fiction and the imagination. And it's no wonder that Melville's contemporary was Walt Whitman, who says, do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I contain multitudes. And that idea of multitudinous was so vital to American life. And now, in the hands of myself, a queer Asian American writer, the idea of a multiplicity towards thinking and being in this country is incredibly inspiring and enriching. And I think to start with who we are, the truth gets us in the room, and it's up to us to decorate it on our own terms. And that's art.
There are so many things I want to unpack from what you just said. Let me just hit two of them. The first, you talked about the American lineage of the autobiography. And it's clear that this book is at least semi-autobiographical, but it is a novel. So why is it a novel? Why did you not write pure autobiography?
Yeah, it's important because I think agency as an artist is very important for me. And going back to the lineage, you know, we began, the American inspiration is that one can create one's mythology for oneself. You know, this is the dream. This is the dream of Western expansion. And when it comes to policy on the ground, what became a dream ended up as violence and genocide and environmental collapse in our Western expansion with Manifest Destiny. But when it came to literature, where the power in the negotiation was always with language, it was incredibly potent space to reinvent oneself towards fiction. And I think what inspired me was that when you write a novel that's based on life, what you're creating is the ghost before the flesh. Often we think of ghosts as what is what remains once the body leaves. But when you write a novel, you're writing a future. You're writing a futurity, a reality and a world based on your life, but one you've never really lived, right? Never truly enacted down to the T. And that negotiation was incredibly powerful for me as an artist, because the novel before that, in the hands of Tolstoy and Turgenev, the great Russian writers, and all those folks, it was part of the large scope of a stage. And I wanted to blend the borders to say that American life is inspiring for art. We don't have to aim for timelessness. We can put CVS in there. We can put fentanyl and opioids in there because that's what we're dealing with. We can put Dunkin' Donuts in there because it becomes a time capsule and a map of thinking and feeling as a way of informing the imagination.
You've said a couple of minutes ago, you talked about the multiplicity of life and of identity. One of the things that struck me in reading the book as a reader was the intersectionality in the book is so striking. You've got poverty meets immigration meets oxy and fentanyl and heroin meets, as you've noted, queer bodies meets the Vietnam War meets New England. Mm-hmm. In reading the book, it seems that it's to get the full power of your art, to use your term. You have to be able to embrace and sort of take in all of those identities at once. Yeah. But is this also a story where one could come to it from one of those places? You know, someone, a Vietnamese immigrant, or someone who's queer, or someone who's experienced poverty in the Northeast. Do you have to take it all in at once, or can you appreciate the art taking in a piece of it at a time?
Yeah, I think that's the joy of the reader's participation. It's up to them. I would say that for me, the novel in the Western tradition asks of us to have a linear plot, one that uses conflict to progress the story. And great literature has been created that way, but one of the pitfalls is that conflict-driven plot becomes almost its own protagonist, where people are fed into the wood chipper of plot, and they become props. And I think for me, it was more important to surrender or even refuse plot in order to gain people. You know, in this book, there's white agrarian farmers, there's Vietnamese refugees and immigrants, there's Dominican immigrants living in the intersections of Hartford, there's queer bodies, there's poor bodies, there's rich bodies. I think I didn't want to compromise one label over another because American life is that complicated and that rich. And instead of a linear plot, I saw this book like a flower. Every petal is its own thing, but it requires all of the petals blooming in unison to create a rose. And I think that's what American life is.
You talk about Rose. You talk about the mother character. I'd like to have you read a small portion from the start of the book, both because it's a set of memories of her that are complicated, but also because I want listeners to be able to get a feel for the flow and the art and really the poetry inside this novel. Mm-hmm. This is from the start of the book for our listeners.
Sure. The time we went to Goodwill and piled the cart with items that had a yellow tag. Because on that day, a yellow tag meant an additional 50% off. I pushed a cart and leaped on the back bar, gliding, feeling rich with our bounty of discarded treasures. It was your birthday. We were splurging. "Do I look like a real American?" you said, pressing a white dress to your length. It was slightly too formal for you to have any occasion to wear, yet casual enough to hold a possibility of use, a chance. I nodded, grinning. The cart was so full by then I no longer saw what was ahead of me. The time with the kitchen knife, the one you picked up, then put down, shaking, saying quietly, "Get out, get out." And I ran out the door, down the black summer streets. I ran until I forgot I was 10. Until my heartbeat was all I could hear of myself.
You, in this book, you have these moments often juxtaposed of horrifying abuse or terror or tragedy, and then intimacy and joy and beauty. Are those petals on the flower, to use your metaphor, that have to coexist? Do they have to be side by side like that to fully appreciate them?
Yeah, proximity creates tension. And also, I wanted to enact, you know, mental illness and schizophrenia, which a lot of these women in this novel negotiate, having suffered the trauma of the war and living with mental illness, and that it's almost like switching channels on a TV. And at sometimes that could be horrific, but at times that could be quite beautiful, that when a moment gets really intense, the TV switches or the petal reveals itself, and now you're in a different, more merciful, sweet and tender balm. And that's what it's like. You know, there's no total immersion. is just a constant flickering of hardness and beauty.
Tell us more about the women in this book. They loom so large and powerfully in the main character, Little Dog's life. Tell us about them.
I wanted to really take the advantage of the first-person narrative in the way Ishmael saw Ahab in Moby Dick, Nick Carraway saw Gatsby, in Junior saw Oscar Wilde in Junior Diaz. I felt that there's an opportunity to take the eye and turn it into a searchlight. And for me, it was to amplify the lives of these women. Often, it is the men who create the wars, and it's the women who clean it up. And they clean it up emotionally, psychically. They clean it up physically. They heal these broken bodies. And I think for me, the question was, at what cost? I didn't want to romanticize them into women warriors or heroes. I wanted to see this is the cost when women lay their bodies on the line to recuperate entire families after a war. The cost is their own mental health, is their own joy. And then the question for me is, how do they find joy? How do they find it on their own terms? And it's not a spoiler that, for me, one of the proudest moments is that the book ends on the laughter of an Asian American woman.
Why does that make you feel so proud?
I don't think I've seen it before, you know, and that for a book full of language, for it to end on wordless joy, to me seems like such a feat to attempt.
One of the things that strikes me in the book, Rose, the character in the book, works in a nail salon, and your mom has worked in a nail salon. And the battering and the degradation of her health from working in a nail salon. I had a colleague at one point that did research on the long-term impacts of women working in nail salons because of the toxicity of the environment.
Yeah.
How is your mom?
Yeah.
How is she today?
Well, she has cancer. She has stage 4 breast cancer.
I'm sorry.
So it's all tied, you know, and it's common among nail salon workers. And this, again, we talk about the cost, the price, but she's incredibly proud. You know, she's able to see, you know, her life amplified, the people like her amplified in literature, which is a very, you know, it has a very noble position in American life. And for that to be casted there, it's an incredibly enriching moment for her. And I think for the first time, we're starting to see Vietnamese American working class life in America and asking about the second and third generation. Where do we go from here? We're starting to see that enacted in art and literature. And it's very exciting. She can see that. And so she's happy. You know, illness is a brutal teacher, and it teaches you how to live better. And you know, after her initial diagnosis, and now that she's on her meds and she's responding well, her life is better.
What else did you try to show or depict or tell the story of for the first time in this book?
One of the things that excited me, you know, as an opportunity in the novel was to show queerness, queer bodies, queer sex. Literature is often afraid or wary of showing the body in sex, in pleasure. For queer folks, that's often how we discover ourselves, and particularly in terms of failure. You know, in this book, there's multiple botched sex scenes, and failure in America is often seen as something that we should hide. But for queer people, failure is a way forward. No one taught us the birds and the bees. You know, rarely do we get that conversation. And I would even say that one of the book's thesis is that failure is the first stage of innovation, which is so prominent in queer lives.
One of the characters in the book, Trevor, who Little Dog has his first sexual encounters with, also, it seems, represents a kind of masculinity that would in no way embrace failure.
Right.
So tell us about the meeting of those two sets of principles, this masculinity that says there is only strength in success or destruction.
Right.
And failure is how we find ourselves and find innovation.
It's easy to look at a character like Trevor, a poor, you know, white kid living in, you know, a mobile home with his father who's drunk. It's easy to call him redneck or hillbilly. But one thing I learned as an artist and a novelist is that the more you look at something, the more you free it away from its stereotypes. And as I looked at Trevor, I realized, wait a minute, what would happen if someone tried to free themselves from the cage of hegemonic masculinity? What would happen if a white boy started to say no to his own milieu, to betray his elders and breach tenderness? What happens if he does like sunflowers? What happens if he likes sunsets, tenderness, if he likes soft things, if he likes quiet conversation? What would it do? Can he survive it? What is the cost of someone trying to break free from a toxic cage? Can it happen? That was the major inquiry for me.
I don't think it's revealing too much for listeners to say that one thing that Trevor doesn't escape is the opioid crisis.
Right.
And there's something nearly journalistic about the way you are explicit in talking about that crisis, the manufacturing of Oxy, how it's unfolding. Why did you include such sharp detail about that crisis in a book that seems softer around the edges in so many other parts?
Right, right. The section on the opioid facts and Purdue Pharma arrive when the book starts to fall apart. And as you know, halfway through, the prose starts to fall away.
I noticed that.
Into line breaks and poetry. So I guess what happens is, what happens when the ground of fiction, the stage, the contrived aura of storytelling collapses? Often we think of a great American novel as something that is monolithic, is a bold tome of a statement of a generation. For me, my participation in the American novel had to deal with actual disintegration. And so when the book starts to disintegrate, the lyrical voice levitates and the facts stand on their own, because after art, the facts remain. We can write a novel, we can create a piece of art, but the lives that are lost through policy, through capitalistic, you know, huge pharma that robbed so many futures in our region, those lives are always lost. And I wanted the novel to be a reckoning. I did not want to escape. I wanted the novel to slowly turn into a mirror of who we are. And that's who we are. Purdue Pharma started in Stamford, Connecticut, and it followed the routes of I-91 all the way up to Maine and down to Appalachia. That's what happened to us. And one of the opportunities of a novel is to be a map and a record of what it's like. You know, when we read The Odyssey, it's also an anthropological gem. When I read The Odyssey, I said, my goodness, back then, they slaughtered a lot of lambs. Every time something happened, 50 lambs were slaughtered. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it doesn't really do much for the book, but it helps you understand how these folks saw the world and what happened to them. And in the same way, you know, the opioid epidemic will be one of the legacies of New England. And I think one of the questions is, how do we find joy? How do we make it out of here?
We're talking with poet and writer Ocean Vuong. I'd love to have you read one more passage for our listeners. And this is, as you describe it, in a part of the book where the novel has started to fall apart. And there's a moment where Little Dog actually talks fairly self-consciously about writing. And I wonder if you could read that for our listeners.
Absolutely. You asked me what it's like to be a writer, and I'm giving you a mess. I know. But it's a mess, Ma. I'm not making this up. I made it down. That's what writing is. After all the nonsense, getting down so low, the world offers a merciful new angle, a larger vision made of small things. The lint, suddenly a huge sheet of fog, exactly the size of your eyeball.
What does it mean to get down so low? Yeah. And if you are getting down so low, how is this about tragedy without being tragic?
Right, right. Often we think of writing as elevated language. We think of poetry as elevation. And I think there's an odd vertical negotiation when we think of art making in the West, that something is on the peak. And I think this is why a lot of literature gets hold into elitism and the ivory towers. And I think for me, literature coming from the oral tradition of our ancestors was part of life. And I want to reclaim that as something absolutely malleable. And life is tragic. Life is challenging. You know, one of the things that I'm proud of in this book is that there are no villains and no victims. And what I mean by that is that there are victims. There's victims of abuse, there's victims of drug abuse, of war. But I think whether we endure or experience victimhood is up to us. And language is the inquiry into that possibility for me.
You talk in that section about writing being a mess, essentially. You work with young writers today. You're on faculty at UMass Amherst. Yeah. I imagine students clamor to take your class. What would be your advice to young writers who might be listening today and might be inspired by what they're hearing from you?
A short bit would be, scare yourself, but don't be scared of yourself. Just negotiate fear as a reality of living and making art in this country. Often we're terrified of fear, but I think it's important because fear and doubt tells us that we care. Innately, we care so much that we want to get it right. So honor your fear, honor your doubt, turn doubt into a source of energy because it means you're respecting what you do.
That's Ocean Vuong, author of On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. He's a writer, a poet, and an assistant professor at UMass Amherst. Thanks for being at Radio Boston, Ocean.
Thank you so much. It's a deep pleasure.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait. Don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.